Tomorrow's high 76. The current number, humidity 71%. It is 80 degrees Kenosha, 79 in Racine, wind southwest at 9. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe, a wonderful song from the film The Harvey Girls, and it is to get us in the mood for what promises to be a very fun morning show. Today, we're going to be focusing on the wonderful pastime of model train collecting, and we're going to be doing so with two different interviews, one of them newly recorded, the other from the morning show archives dating from 20 years ago. The more recent interview is about a book that was released to celebrate the 125th anniversary of the leading manufacturer of model trains over the years, Lionel. And in part two, that archival interview is with the author of an interesting book called Playing with Trains. Here's part one of today's program. I have before me an absolutely wonderful, fascinating, beautiful book called Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, A Photo History of an American Icon. We are talking about the most famous of all model trains, the Lionel trains. And these were a ubiquitous part of so many American households for many, many generations. And one of the people who has been fascinated by this phenomenon for most of his life is my morning show guest, Roger Karp, who received his first Lionel train back in 1956, starting out with one small steam engine and a couple of freight cars, and from there has sprung a lifelong devotion to the story of Lionel trains. He has done a great deal of study on this, written a number of different books, and in fact, 20-plus books. And this latest is an absolute classic. It is a beautiful, beautiful book, start to finish, telling the story of Lionel trains with both text and also amazing, illuminating photographs, many coming from the Lionel Train Company itself, but many coming from ordinary Americans who captured the images of youngsters playing with their model trains. And this became such an important part of American life, and to see it captured in so many beautiful, breathtakingly beautiful photographs is really inspiring. This book is published by Project Roar Publishing, again titled Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, A Photo History of an American Icon. And Roger Karp, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Greg, and good morning to you and all your listeners.
I have to confess right off the bat that I come to this as someone who never in his whole life has been blessed to own a model train. It just was not possible, or just nothing that ever crossed my path. But over the several decades that I've done this morning show program, I've had a couple of different opportunities to speak with the author of books about model trains. And I have come to really appreciate what a fascinating field this is. And how exciting for you to be able to, in a sense, devote so much of your professional life to something that has given you so much pleasure.
I've been so fortunate in that respect, and just been able to really take my own interest and expand upon it, meet at one time some former Lionel executives and employees, and as well as talk with many, many people over the years who have enjoyed Lionel trains and made them central parts of their life.
First of all, in just a brief nutshell, explain where this begins. That is, when do we first see something resembling a model train? And when does this really take off in spectacular fashion?
You probably had miniatures, toy trains, not long after you had full-size trains, which was about 200 years ago. Of course, the first ones were pull toys or push toys along the floor. But by around 1900, some brilliant inventors and entrepreneurs were looking to harness electricity and drive these miniatures so that kids no longer had to touch them to get them to move. And among those was a young man who was growing up in New York City named Joshua Lionel Cowan. So you can see he took his middle name for the company. He was, say, 125 years ago, what Bill Gates, Steve Jobs are in our world today. Someone who saw the latest technology, knew it had commercial possibilities, and then had the brilliance to translate that and show how kids, but really families, should make this a necessity.
I wonder if you could do your best to explain why model trains established themselves in such a powerful way versus other possibilities. I mean, you know, there's such a thing, of course, as model planes and model boats and model cars. I mean, and of course, such things exist. But it seems like model trains took off in a really spectacular fashion. I mean, really leaving all of those other possibilities very much in the dust. What is sort of the magic of model trains that would explain why they were so incredibly popular in so many homes of young children?
Well, Greg, I love the word that you used, magic, and they did seem magical. And one of the places to take that magic was what were known as Christmas gardens. These are the little displays that people had been building beneath their Christmas trees. And really, by the early part of the 20th century, the farms or the mangers or the little towns that people had beneath their Christmas trees were being supplemented and improved with a loop of track on which a train ran. And all of a sudden, something that had seemed like a plaything for children became part of a family's life and tradition. And I think that played a big part in it. Another one was how Lionel brilliantly marketed their trains as more than playthings. And this is really a central theme of my book. But they became part of family life. It was a way for parents and grandparents to play with, interact with, and connect with children, and for children to learn what it meant to become a responsible, productive adult. And you see it in the advertising, and you see it in the photographs that I've collected. And then you would see it when celebrities were shown with toy trains, and all of a sudden these trains became just wonderful. You could almost call them status symbols. A family had arrived when it had a train to put under the tree and play with, have fun with, and it was just the best thing to unite a family.
Mm. And of course, there's also something really special about the fact that at least with certain kinds of model trains, such as many that the Lionel Company created, you're actually seeing the thing actually do what it was built to do, but just on a small scale that you can see up close. I mean, as opposed to, I mean, a toy car that isn't really driving. There's no gasoline in its tiny little there's no gas gauge or gas tank, and the plane isn't really flying. But these trains, I mean, at least certain trains of the highest order, would actually be operating somewhat like an actual train. And the way that these small little wheels would move on the tracks and so on, there is a level of realism and energy and dynamism that I should think was incredibly alluring for youngsters and for adults as well, for that matter.
Very, very much so. Because remember, through well into the second half of the 20th century, when you wanted to travel a distance, you took a train. And they were glamorous. And then one of the things that Lionel did was it marketed what were called accessories, say freight loaders or signals or stations, so that besides having your loop of track and your train, you could build your own railroad system. And this would take several years. But Lionel, again, great marketing. Great engineering came up with this, and people were finding more and more ways to have fun. And in the photographs in my book, you will often see the accessories with the trains, whether they were in movie stills or whether they publicity shots. There was one of Betty Grable with accessories, Joe DiMaggio, Roy Campanella, great athletes, great movie stars, television performers, politicians. Everyone wanted a Lionel train.
That reminds me of kind of a touching moment in the book, and we'll explain in just a little bit a little more about what we find in the pages of your wonderful book. One of the photographs that we see is actually of a book called All Aboard, and if I remember correctly from the small essay that accompanies this particular photograph. This acknowledges the fact that model trains were not necessarily something that would be within the budget of every single American family. And this book, All Aboard, was probably for many families of limited means, where that little boy or perhaps little girl just dreamt of having a model train. Having a book about model trains would be a substitute. But, I mean, I appreciate that photograph is here, and it acknowledges the fact that this was a joy that not every single family could necessarily gain access to.
It's a great point. We need to remember these electric trains were expensive. They were not in every family's budget. Is one of the engineers at Lionel that I interviewed about 30 years ago, he was elderly, he said to me, always remember, we thought we were making electrical appliances. We were as good as GE or Westinghouse. And when I did further research, a Lionel set in, say, the late 1940s cost as much as a big radio console or even a small washing machine. So for a family to decide on whether it was going to get a Lionel train, That was a big investment. But it was, as Lionel always said, it was an investment in happiness.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Roger Karp about a wonderful book he has just written and released called Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, A Photo History of an American Icon. It tells the story of this particular company, and even beyond that to some extent, talks about and celebrates the hobby of model trains, and does so not only through text, but also through an array of really magnificent photographs, many originating from the Lionel Train Corporation itself, and many of these photographs coming from ordinary families, capturing the wonder and joy of a model train in their midst. At what point did it occur to you that after all the different books that you have written about model trains and Lionel trains especially, that a book of this nature tilted so much towards photographs would be, in a sense, a worthwhile venture? I guess another way to say it is, at what point did you realize that there would be this treasure trove of a photographic legacy that would be such a wonderful capstone for this particular kind of book?
Well, Greg, I've been working for Classic Toy Trains magazine almost from the time it started. I've been with it since 1988, and over those years, I've been really lucky to be given access to a lot of personal photographs, photographs that had belonged to Lionel employees, and over the years, I'd collected them, and then I learned about photo archives and movie stills and publicity shots, so I had a really nice collection of photographs. When the pandemic came, I was looking for a new book project, and I challenged myself, could I write 400 words about each of these photographs? Could I do so in a way that would take it beyond the hobby and find some social and cultural significance in what the photo was showing in the relationship between, say, the child or the family or the celebrity who was using the train and the train itself? And my background as a PhD in American history really helped me tie these photos to larger currents in American life and see how these trains were influencing and reflecting the major values, the beliefs of our society.
You know, it's really true also that when you look carefully at these photographs, and in particular, when you look at the facial expression of these youngsters, you really see a very special sort of pride and energy and joy that is downright heartwarming. And I'm glad that you take the time to encourage us to look at these photographs with that kind of time and care, because if we fail to do that, then we fail to see some of what is here.
I agree, and that was really the fun of it, whether it's an ordinary family in the middle of America or whether it's Nat King Cole and his young son, that it's the relationship between the generations, which is why I really think my book is the perfect Father's Day gift. It will start conversations among the generations about favorite toys, trains, and what they meant. And that's why, to me, sometimes people will say, well, what is my old train worth? And I'll always say the sentimental value will always be greater than the monetary value. And I think, short of having the trains themselves, I believe these photographs can do exactly that, get people talking, appreciating each other, and really link the generations. And that, to me, that's just so, so important.
Right. At one point you say, the more time spent looking at an old photograph showing toy trains, the more personal it becomes and entwined with your identity. An image taken long ago invariably sparks recollections of your childhood and the toys you loved. It nurtures memories of your own experiences with an electric train. The sights, sounds, and smells come back to life. You fasten on the warm memories revived by the vintage photo as vehicles to explore your past and reminisce about what you had. And I think that's all true. And I also want to just reiterate the fact that, you know, I, as someone who never got to own a toy train, model train, absolutely loved this book. And I think, you know, in that paragraph, you're touching on the fact that even if we're not reminded of toy trains in our own past, we are reminded of our own childhoods. I wonder if you could talk about the photography contest that was sponsored by Lionel, in which they actually encouraged people to take photographs of the model trains in their homes. Why they did that and what ended up happening? I mean, how many photographs ended up flooding into the Lionel corporate offices?
There were two photo contests that Lionel sponsored. One was in 1930, so again, right at the height of the Great Depression, and it asked kids to take pictures of their trains at home and submit them. And many, many entries were received. Unfortunately, I don't know that any have survived. Then again, in 1947, Lionel sponsored a contest at its central showroom in downtown Manhattan, and it invited anybody and everybody to bring their camera, come to the showroom, and take pictures on the large displays that Lionel had in its showroom. Thousands of people showed up, and many, many thousands of photographs were taken. I know of only one that has survived, and I show it in my book. I have to say, it breaks my heart. I would love to know what happened to all the others, because it would be such a wonderful snapshot of Lionel at its glory.
Right. There is a really interesting photograph in your book that actually was taken right around that same time as that first photography contest, 1930 or 1931, which, of course, as you just said, was in the depths of the Depression when the Lionel Company was struggling mightily. And this is a photograph of a distinguished older gentleman with several young boys surrounding him. And this photograph captures a moment in which Lionel Trains received a very powerful and influential endorsement at a time when they were needing to do all that they could to stay afloat in those challenging times. Can you tell our listeners about this story?
Very much. Lionel took a new tack in its promotions during the 1930s. It would have, in this case, a railroad executive. Often it was locomotive engineers endorse Lionel Trains for their realism. And again, it was one more way, because Lionel was picking the people. Locomotive engineers were heroes to kids across America. So it was having those heroes say, hey, these trains are just like mine. Kids, this is what you really want to get. You want to ask mom and dad or Santa Claus to bring you. And it was a time when Lionel was pioneering the use of, say, a whistle in its steam engine, flashing lights. And then after World War II, the greatest innovation, smoke out of a smokestack.
Incredible. One of the other kinds of photographs that we see during in your book are four or five stills that are taken from various motion pictures. And this was a way also in which the wonder and fun of owning model trains was celebrated on quite a wide scale. And I wonder, maybe you could choose one or two of these films that included scenes with model trains and the difference that this would make in terms of helping to celebrate this.
The place to start is a movie from 1937 called Four is a Crowd with Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn. There was an older man in it. He's sort of a stuffed shirt, very distant. But his hobby is toy trains. And with Lionel's help, Warner Brothers built an extraordinary model railroad. I think it was 40 by 80 feet on a back lot in Hollywood. We see scenes from it in the movie. It just fascinates us. But the trains were a way that this older man was made to seem more human, more approachable, more boyish. And at the same time, Errol Flynn could use the trains as a way to win his granddaughter. So that was one that really stands up. And there's another one, The World, the Flesh, and the Devil. It's a 1959 movie with Harry Belafonte in which he thinks he is the last human being on Earth, having survived a nuclear blast. He ends up in an apartment in New York, and there is a Lionel train as well as a guitar. And so he has everything he needs to keep himself amused. And it just was fascinating to discover these movies, to see what the trains do. They played central roles in humanizing people, in showing the pleasures of life. And so that's always been just a fun thing to do, is find the movies with the trains.
Absolutely. As you've touched on already, there are various celebrities who engaged in this pastime to different degrees, and several of them are celebrated in your book, including a photograph in which we see the great Joe DiMaggio, one of the towering legends in Major League Baseball, playing with a model train. Tell us what we know about Joe DiMaggio, who ended up being on the cover of Model Builder magazine.
Which was a Lionel publication. Joe DiMaggio fits the place, as was true with also Bill Russell of the Boston Celtics, the great celebrity whose family did not have the money to buy an electric train for him when he was a boy, but he remembered. And so once success came, Joe DiMaggio, like Bill Russell, bought a Lionel train. What made Joe DiMaggio even more important is that, like so many of the workers who built the Lionel trains at the company's factory in northern New Jersey, he or his parents had been born in Italy. So he was a hero, not just for being a great baseball player, but for his background to the workers at the factory. Joe DiMaggio would visit the factory, and he would just be mobbed. So to have him endorse those trains, to promote them, meant so much. And he, in turn, it gave him a chance to relax and just find a wonderful hobby. So that was so meaningful. The same way to get away from the bustling world was true with Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, who also made Lionel trains his passion.
Hmm. I want to give you a chance to talk about a photograph that is adorned with the headline, "I'll be home for Christmas if only with my trains." And of course, that's a slight takeoff on a familiar Christmas song, and it touches on the reality of what it meant to be a soldier far from home anytime, but especially over the holidays. And this particular photograph is one of the most poignant in the book. Explain to our listeners what is in this photograph, what we are seeing, and its significance.
Glad to do so. This was a hard one to find and then to learn more about it. It's a picture taken right during World War II. It shows a number of soldiers who had been wounded overseas, I believe in North Africa. They have been brought back to the United States to a hospital in one of the boroughs of New York, maybe Staten Island, to recover. And while they are recovering and they know they're going to be sent back to combat, they have the opportunity to play with a large group of Lionel trains right underneath on the floor by a Christmas tree. And so, for many of these men, they may have never had an electric train before. Again, during the Depression, families probably couldn't afford them. And now that the war is raging, they certainly don't have the chance to play with them. So this is, for many of them, a dream come true. And this, again, was a photo that I wanted to use to show these trains were more than toys. I mean, it seems silly to imagine these soldiers playing with roller skates or a wagon, those kind of toys. But when you put them with the electric trains, they seem boyish in the best sense. They seem relaxed. They can enjoy them and just really be themselves, be approachable, be normal, be the boy next door. It's the same reason that movie studios would pose Betty Grable or Rita Hayworth with Lionel trains to make them seem approachable, normal, and just someone you wanted to get to know.
You also tell us at one point, and when talking about women and Lionel trains, how women, by and large, preferred that these train cars be brightly colored, brightly painted, even though, of course, the typical train cars at the time, I mean, actual train cars were not necessarily painted in lively, bright colors, but at least many housewives and mothers, this was their preference in terms of what these model trains should look like. And is that advice that the Lionel Company followed to any serious extent?
It did indeed, because if you think about it, who is most likely to be buying the gifts for kids at a birthday or Christmas or Hanukkah? It turned out to be it was the moms, the aunts, the grandmothers. And so Lionel had to convince them that these were both beautiful toys, which it did by painting them in dazzling colors, rich browns, deep greens, beautiful blues, but also to convince them that these toys would enlighten their sons, their nephews, their grandsons, and help them become productive citizens, become better men. So together, aesthetically and I guess functionally, Lionel was using its trains to please women who would then buy them for their children, often boys, but a number of girls also got Lionel trains. And again, it was just to make them better. They had an educational aspect to them.
Hmm. Let's finish up by giving you a chance to talk about this whole matter of fathers and sons, although certainly there had to have been little girls from time to time, at least, who would enjoy this hobby as well. But there's no question but that it was extensively marketed for little boys and for their fathers, and marketed as something for them to enjoy together. What did this hobby represent in terms of the connection between fathers and sons?
I think every little boy looks to his dad or his grandfather as a hero, as someone to emulate, to grow up, to become. And so Lionel worked on this. It played upon this and suggested, boys, get your dad involved. Have your dad teach you how to take your train off the floor and build what we call a layout. Use carpentry skills. Use wiring and electrical skills. Have fun together making scenery, little towns and forests. At the same time, and especially after World War II, there was a worry that dads were becoming too wrapped up in their jobs, were becoming distant from their families. And so Lionel said, dads, here's a way to relax. Get on the floor, have fun with your little boy. And as you do that, the generations will grow closer. Sisters and moms should also be involved. This was something to unite the family and make way for a better future using the Lionel trains. And so many of the photographs, again, whether they're ordinary families, I have one in there of a family here in Milwaukee where you can just see them. They had planned the toy train layout, and now the sister, the brother, or the daughter and the son and the dad, they're all working together to build their miniature version of the world. And that's why, again, I think it's just perfect for Father's Day. And I encourage families to get the book, sit down, think about where toy trains have been in their past and in their future, and start planning to build that next toy train layout.
Hmm. The book, again, is Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, A Photo History of an American Icon. How many photographs are in this book, actually? I neglected to count.
Close to 250.
Right. It's a beautifully laid out book. I wish this wasn't radio. I wish there was a way for me to hold the book up and show people just how beautiful it is. It's wonderfully, lovingly crafted, published by Project Roar Publishing. Roger Karp, thank you so much for creating this lovely book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was great to speak with you.
Greg, thank you so much. It was wonderful. My book, Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, A Photo History of an American Icon, is available through Amazon and ProjectRoar.com. Greg, I thank you again. I wish everyone a happy, healthy Father's Day.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. To finish out today's program, we're going to stay with the wonderful hobby of model trains and hear a portion of a morning show interview that was recorded and initially broadcast 20 years ago, back in the fall of 2005. On several different occasions on the morning show here on WGTD, we have talked about the hobby of model trains. One of the leading magazines about model trains is published here in southeastern Wisconsin. So that's one of the things which has inspired at least a couple of those previous interviews. Now I'm really happy that I can speak today with Sam Posey, the author of a book called Playing with Trains, A Passion Beyond Scale. Sam Posey comes to this task with a very interesting array of qualifications. He was a professional race car driver for a long, long time and has been a commentator for ABC Sports and has written actually about his racing days. But he is also interested in model trains and interested in this book in trying to help all of us understand what this passion is all about, a passion which has been his since boyhood. And I'm grateful that Sam Posey can join us for a few minutes to talk about his book again called Playing with Trains, A Passion Beyond Scale, which is published by Random House. Sam Posey, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thanks so much. Of course, you speak of southern Wisconsin. My friends at Model Railroader magazine live out in Waukesha there. And I've had many happy trips out to talk with them about the hobby.
Let's talk about first the way in which this hobby came into your own life. It's a way in which it probably has entered the lives of many people.
Well, in my case, it was the classic train under the tree in the post-World War II era. I was born right at the end of the war, and by the time I was five or six, and it was about 1950, my mom bought me, my dad was killed in the war, and my mom bought me a Lionel setup, which she then enlarged upon by getting a professional carpenter to build a table for us in a spare room. So I had a wonderful layout right from the beginning, thanks basically to my mom, who also wired it.
Hmm. So this was an interesting undertaking in a couple of ways. I kind of wondered, and I think I understand a little better now why you mentioned in kind of the same breath, just now in the interview and also in your book, the fact that your father had been killed in the Second World War, that his absence had at least a little bit to do with this as well.
I think so, because my mom obviously stepped up into the role of mom and dad, which was really fantastic of her. But I also think she had a genuine enthusiasm for mechanical things. I mean, she bought some unusual cars, which we still own to this day, like the local fire truck, the first one that mechanically, you know, ever that we had in our local town here. So she liked that kind of thing, and she was in charge of the lighting at a local theater group. So the wiring of the thing came naturally to her.
Hmm. One of the things you mentioned is that as your model train layout became more and more elaborate, you eventually were given permission, at least from time to time, to leave the thing set up as opposed to disassembling it each and every time you were done playing with it. That had to be kind of a sweet moment, I should think.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that's the line in the sand, really, the decisive moment, because when you've got to keep putting it away, it's basically a train set. The minute you can keep it up, it's a train layout. And I've thought most of my life in terms of layouts. And, of course, the one I built here in our own basement with my son is so much a permanent part of the house, I think it would probably be easier to tear the house down than the layout. It's so stoutly built.
I want to get one little technical matter out of the way. You mentioned at some point in the book that you have always worked with a particular scale. I want you to explain to our listeners what you are talking about there.
Okay, well, actually, the Lionel was a larger scale, but when I started building here, it was an HO scale, which is 1 to 87, which means that a locomotive is about it fits in your hand, it's about 6 inches long, it's about 1/8 of an inch to a foot, roughly, and it happens to be a scale which I don't know who dreamt it up or what the origins of it are, but it just is an ideal scale for modeling things. To make a tree, for example, you just grab a bunch of lichen or some weed and stick a twig in it, and you've got a tree. I'm oversimplifying, but the point is you can make things easily in HO scale. It would be much tougher. Let's suppose you were trying to model a tree that was a foot tall. You'd have to get into each individual branch, and it would be a nightmare. An HO, it's got enough detail to seem very, very real, and yet it seems relatively easy to assemble the buildings and to do the kinds of scenery that I did. I know came very easily.
That's a fascinating thing I'd not thought about at all. The fact that a scale could be too large or it could be too small. I mean, too small to be able to make out those details or to be or to easily produce them. But if something's too big, you almost have to create too much detail within it, and also the thing just becomes too big.
It's so much harder to get a reasonable layout together. I mean, the bigger scales, some of them are ideally suited to garden railways outside where there's a lot of room and the plants can be in scale. But if you're trying to do one inside, it can be tough. Now, of course, the advantage of a bigger scale is that you get more detailing in the cars and the locomotives and so forth. That's terrific. It's just harder to build the scenery by a lot. Get down in the smaller scale, like N scale, for example, which is a scale about half the size of HO. And in my case, I'm 60 years old. I can't see them. That's a problem. you know, I don't think I'd ever be able to put them on the tracks. I mean, obviously people do, and I could too, but it strikes me as just a little bit too small. But if you live in the city and your space is confined, suddenly N scale, can be a wonderful choice.
Hmm. You talk about how the typical boys in the school that you attended could essentially make two choices. And so your identity was very much tied up on whether you were this or whether you were that. Explain that to our listeners.
Well, in my class in New York, a lot of us had forts. I didn't have a fort. I had a train. And the guys that had trains and the guys that had forts just squared off against each other. Then there was the subcategory. If you had trains, did you have Lionel or American Flyer? And those of us who had Lionel thought that we were immensely superior and had much better judgment than the people that had American Flyer. I still feel that way, of course, but then nobody's perfect.
Sam Posey is the author of Playing with Trains, A Passion Beyond Scale, a book published by Random House. This interview was recorded and initially broadcast 20 years ago, back in 2005. Sadly, at least at this point in time, what you just heard is all that survives from this interview. I hope someday to uncover the original interview on cassette tape so you can hear it in its entirety. Once again, we played both of these interviews today in honor of the 125th anniversary of Lionel. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on the morning show, a look at homelessness and its root causes. My author is Maria Foscarinas, who has worked for a number of years in the field of homelessness. And she is the author of a book called And Housing for All, The Fight to End Homelessness in America. By the way, our published schedule called for Yvonne McDonald Harris, the executive director of HALO, to join us on Thursday's morning show. Something came up in her schedule and she was forced to postpone her visit to WGTD. So we will be sharing an interview with her sometime, I hope, next week instead as a follow-up. On Friday, out of the archives for Pride Month, we have Susan Stryker and the author of a fascinating book called Transgender History, The Roots of Today's Revolution. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We remind you that the morning show is archived on our website, wgtd.org, and is also available as a podcast to hear a different morning show 7 days a week. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today is going to be partly sunny and hot with a 40% chance of afternoon rain, a high of 91 degrees. Overnight, mostly cloudy skies, a 60% chance of rain, overnight low of 65. Tomorrow, Wednesday, warm and rainy, a high of just 76 degrees. Sunshine returning on Thursday and Friday, and then getting quite hot over this coming weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.